Welcome to Westerns with Dad. This is Matt.
And this is Dad.
And today we are talking about My Name is Nobody from 1973. Wow, this is a weird one, huh? This is going to be a
nome
strange.
Il nome è nessuno. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You notice all the credits were in Italian?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, this is a proper spaghetti Western in a lot of sense. Well, not a proper one. It's a parody, satire, but it comes right. from, it is born of the same place as all the spaghetti Westerns. Both literally being, you know, from Italy, and also figuratively from the mind of Sergio Leone.
Brainchild, yeah.
And this is sort of a satire, sort of a takedown of the genre from the guy who, for all intents and purposes, invented the genre. This is kind of after the wave had crested, I guess, on the Eastwood films. He'd moved off to America, the Italian cinema, the market was apparently giallos, cop thrillers were getting made now with more frequency. So this is sort of in the twilight days of the classic era of spaghetti westerns.
73, is that right? 74, something like that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
73.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, that was a short run, really. I mean, mostly it was just the Leone and his contemporaries, about a 10-year period. And this was near the end of it. And this is almost a parody of spaghetti westerns, I would say.
Well, this came after the Trinity series, right?
Yes. Yes. Uh-huh. This is one of the stars of the film, Terrence Hill. Well, I guess he's best known for this and a couple of films, the first of which was My Name is Trinity. And he was a similar character from what I could tell. I've never seen these films, My Name is Trinity. I'd never seen a Terrence Hill film, frankly. I did not know who this guy was. Walking into this movie, My Name is Nobody, I knew very little about it. I knew it was sort of a spaghetti western and that it was supposedly kind of a comedy. And I was pretty sure that it starred Terrence Stamp.
Terrence Stamp. And yeah. In fact, I think one of us came up with the name Terrence Mann, who was the director.
No. Terrence Malick is the director. Terrence Mann is he's a Broadway actor. He's been in some movies, but he's mostly famous for creating the role of Javert in Les Miserables.
On stage?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay. Terrence Mann.
Okay, this is none of those people, though. It's Terrence Hill.
No, this is Terrence Hill.
Yeah, uh-huh. Terrence Stamp would have been interesting, huh? He's... I mean, I don't know how to describe this guy because I was unfamiliar with him before I watched this film. I mean, he's sort of a big blonde dork, I guess.
he plays it that way anyway. Yeah. I mean, you know. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But.
He's a comic actor, right?
Yeah, comic actor. There are a few moments in the film where he actually gets serious.
Yeah, occasionally.
For a few seconds. Uh-huh. But good-looking guy.
Very, yeah. Uh-huh.
You know?
In good shape.
Blonde, blue-eyed.
Co-stars with Henry Fonda in this film. The Henry Fonda. This is the last Western he ever made, apparently.
Right.
And this is a guy at the end of his career. So looking very old. This is after... Once Upon a Time in the West. This is much more traditional Henry Fonda. It's like a play on his hero characters from the West, I would say.
Well, it's perfect. It's perfect because, you know, after all the roles he's played in Westerns over the years, this one is him trying to retire.
Yeah.
As a gunslinger.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What this is, I guess, in way of synopsis, I don't know how to do a synopsis of this film, really, because it's really just a bunch of episodes.
Vignettes.
And I mean, there is sort of a central core idea, but...
what is that, by the way? Okay. The central core idea?
Okay, the central core idea, not really what the film's about, but if you had to describe a plot to it, it is Henry Fonda's playing a aging Western hero, gunslinger, sort of haunted by his legacy. He's trying to escape that. And a character sort of arrives out of the mist almost. without
he shows
a name.
Up in a river.
Yeah. Uh-huh. The character is named Nobody. Or maybe just doesn't have a name. And who has decided that that Henry Fonda, Agent Jack Beauregard, whose character is playing, must become a Western hero, a legend. He takes steps to ensure that Henry Fonda's character becomes a legend. And it's sort of a Twilight of the Gunslinger kind of story. A famous man dealing with his own legacy, I guess.
The interesting part about this is, now we've seen a lot of movies of gunslingers trying to retire.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, at the end of their careers and you know, giving their words of advice to other future gunslingers. No, you don't want mm-hmm. this. You don't want this kind of life. You
yeah,
know,
yeah.
It'll ruin you. It'll destroy you. There'll be some other youngster come along and want it all. Want to take you down.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference here is that Terrence Hill wants to build him up into this legend before he takes him down. Because that's the ultimate goal is for Terrence Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Right? To assume the mantle of the fastest gun in the West.
I mean, maybe that's what he wants.
yeah.
You could float any number of fan theories about what the hell is actually going on in this film, and I'd be like, well, maybe, you know, this is.
well, speaking of plot, now who the hell is Sullivan? What does all the gold in Sullivan have to do with the plot?
Oh man. Okay. So basically,
because there's so little about that, mm-hmm. you know, there's so many little vignettes that are sort of planned to show us the speed and prowess of Terrence Hill, you know, mm-hmm. as a gunslinger, and you know, that also helped the comic part of the film. But I had a tough time following what the hell was going on in terms of the overall plot.
Yeah, it's not explicitly clear. I don't think it matters much in the long run. I mean, this is right. You know, this is a setup for vignettes, as we've said, you know, comic set pieces. Basically, there is a mining concern that wants to get rid of Beauregard. That is, you know, they're laundering illegal money from a gang.
Do we know why they want to get rid of Beauregard?
No, not entirely, not clearly. Mm. I mean, honestly, I kind of wanted to watch this film again to get the entirety of it. I didn't have time. but it's like narratively, you know, there's an entire gang of bad guys as well as a corrupt mining magnate Sullivan that are working together who are trying to take down Beauregard, the Henry Fonda character. It doesn't yeah. seem like he's after them or anything, or like he's trying to expose them. He's trying to pay off a debt and leave. Yeah, like
he just wants to take a boat ride to Australia.
so I I'm not entirely sure what the deal is or what we're meant to, or whether we're supposed to worry about these characters at all. They're hardly in it, you know.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think we're supposed to concentrate on Hill and Fonda.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, and that whole thing.
I feel a little like a dummy floating it this way in the context of trying to speak intelligently about the film. Just being like, yeah, well, you know, I don't think it matters, so. I'm sorry I don't have a clear idea, but, you know, it don't. It's It is so not the main concern of this film, what the plot is. There's a gang right. of there's an army of bandits or something chasing after Henry Fonda. They're called the Wild Bunch. It's a Sam Peckinpah joke, sort of, and and that's about right. it. There's also some mining baron that also wants to take down Beauregard and is hiring assassins to do that. It's basically so they have, you know, bad guys to play off of in the copious comic set pieces.
Right. Don't you just love the scene where the Wild Bunch comes riding into town and they kind of take over the town for a few minutes while they load up their saddlebags with dynamite?
Yeah.
And then they're right away.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, they're just pretty ineffective.
Come in, get the dynamite, and leave.
Well, this film is not even sometimes, frequently experimental to an infuriating degree. This is a really, really irritatingly chancy and weird narrative setup for this film. like, you know, stuff like the you know, there's things that could maybe not even exist at all going on in this movie time to time. Characters that could be not human. Characters that could be, you know, ancient Indian trickster gods who decided to, you know, that would explain it as much as anything. What the movie really is about, really, aside from all this stuff that it, you know, kind of has going on in it, which is a lot. What it actually is about is a Bugs Bunny cartoon starring Terrence Hill. Like, it's this guy getting into situations and being kind of a smartass or being kind of weird, you know, and ruffling the feathers of somebody who's kind of an asshole, and then he somehow gets the better of that guy comically, you know, and you know,
yeah, many times
drops a potted plant on his head somehow. You know, that kind of thing tends to just, you know, that sort of stuff. He sort of seems like a Forrest Gump character sometimes. Sometimes he's a lot more mischievous and puckish. Sometimes he's and sometimes he's just deadly competent with a gun or whatever happens to be around. I played with the idea maybe he's like a guardian angel for Henry Fonda. Maybe he's it could be that the entire movie is Henry Fonda's passage through the afterlife. So many things going on.
I don't think that was the intention. Nope. I really don't.
Well, you could make the argument, I feel, like that the Wild Bunch, the guys, the army of 150 bandits chasing him around, is some sort of Ghost Riders in the Sky motif.
All right. I love it.
I mean, all of this stuff is, you know, it's something to kind of, if you're trying to, like, piece together what exactly is going on in this film, this is the stuff I came up with.
Well, I think it's all the Hill, the Terrence Hill-Henry Fonda relationship. I mean, that's where the focus is. Mm-hmm. And this other thing with Sullivan and the gold and the Wild Bunch is just extraneous stuff that, you know, is very loosely connected somehow. Which,
to give the indication that it has a traditional narrative structure.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's the opening here. The opening. This film is directed by Tanino Valeri, I believe is the name. Is that it? Let me double
check. Yeah, Tanino. That's what you said. Tanino mm-hmm. Valeri. Yeah.
Tanino Valeri. It is kind of credited to, you know, Sergio Leone a little bit. The only credit Leone actually has is it's a pretty hilarious one from an idea of Sergio Leone. You know, the rumor on the Wikipedia street is that he kind of directed bits and pieces of it, had a much steadier hand, stronger hand as a producer of this film than just, you know, that credit would suggest. And this opening sequence of Henry Fonda being stalked by hitmen while he gets a shave is widely said to be a Sergio Leone sequence. It's also a direct parody of Once Upon a Time in the West. So, arguably, that makes sense. Yeah. It does feel like a different film that's being set up here. Because it's not a comic undercutting.
Different from Once Upon a Time in the West?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But it doesn't, it's not a parody of that sequence so much as it's a scene very much like that. You know, with a ticking clock overlaid over everything. And he's getting the shave and he holds a gun to the guy's crotch during it.
Right.
Because everyone's hunting him and he eventually shoots a guy through the window, through the barber.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. All right. Mm-hmm. The kid has to point it out. Wait a minute. How did that happen? You only shot once.
Yeah, he's that good. He's that good. Henry Fonda is. Beauregard. It's a good opening sequence. It's
lots of close-ups, mm-hmm. as usual in Sergio Leone films.
Very Leone, yeah. Uh-huh. And and at the end, he's like, how did he shoot him? How did he shoot just one time? Who is that fast? It's like, nobody's that fast. And then a slam cut to Terrence Hill doing dumb guy stuff in a river, basically.
He's grabbing flies or grasshoppers or something.
Yeah, he's trying to bait lure fish out, yeah.
To lure a fish to the surface so he can whack him with a stick.
Yeah, which is this is something that you see Brer Bear doing or something. You know, it's just like, I mean, I admittedly thought, oh, okay, he's a dumb guy. Like, it's, that was my first impression. It's like, so the movie is, it's about how dumb he is, and it's funny. That's not exactly it, not at all.
No.
But this music also made me think of dumb guy, I gotta say. The theme in this is distinctive.
Yeah, Terrence Hill has his own music.
Mm-hmm.
You notice it's that kind of jaunty, doo 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 doo.
Yeah, like it's whistly. It's dumb.
Acoustic guitar going on in the background.
I mean, it'll get stuck in your head. It's goofy sounding music. It is also by Ennio Morricone, which is hilarious to me. There is a lot of music in this film that sounds like intentional self-parody of a Morricone theme. You know, nothing well, even the, close to be as serious as the Man with No Name.
Man with No Name trilogy, know. Yeah.
But it's all a lot of it is clearly meant to imply that, especially the Wild Bunches theme. Which has the worst music in the film, I think. The Ride of the Valkyries.
The Ride of the Valkyries by Richard Wagner.
But with like blaring horn.
Goes right along with your Bugs Bunny cartoon thing.
I love this movie.
Kill the wabbit, kill the wabbit, kill the
A lot of the sound cues in this movie are straight out of Looney Tunes. Like, anytime there's a bomb, it's going to behave like a Looney Tunes bomb, for sure, you know?
Nobody gets killed, but everybody has their face blackened.
Yeah, that happens like three times, I'm pretty sure. Which is weird, because then in the next scene, they'll shoot three people. But yeah, the bomb just covers them with
some of those guys in the Wild Bunch had to bite the dust there at the end.
Oh yeah, when they start blowing them up, yes, that's true.
Blowing up their saddlebags.
So these characters don't really cross paths for a little while, I would say. It's Beauregard, you know, trying to make his way through the country with people trying to kill him, and being low key about it, and nobody, you know, like falling asleep in a food stall and having people get annoyed at that, and then he sort of slaps him around a little bit, and man, I never had a clear idea what his modus operandi was. Like, sometimes he's way better, sometimes he outwits people. Sometimes he just sort of gives up and wanders off. It's a strange
Well, the idea is for him to come up with $500 as a down payment on a boat trip to Australia, right? I mean, isn't that what Henry Fonda's deal is?
That's Henry Fonda, yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the background on Fonda, and that's ultimately the connection with Sullivan. But, yeah, you're right. Terrence Hill, no clue for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's not until he actually meets up with Fonda that you got any idea what's going on, really. Up until then, it's just, you know, dumb guy catching fish and, you know, sort of smarting off to bullies. And, and yeah, I mean, he's at his most Forrest Gumpy in the first 45 minutes or so, just wandering about. I don't know. Does he have a plan? Clearly he does, but like, man, he just seems like a star man or something that has no idea how humans interact.
Yeah.
Now this is a request episode. This was somebody's request, and we thank you very much for the request. I think this is a film that people would have fond memories over watching when they were younger. And I think that is probably where a lot of the appeal to this comes. Something that occurred to me while watching this movie was The Great Race, a little bit. It's not very similar to that, but it occasionally has a similar comic styling, a fondness for vignettes and set pieces and goofiness. The Great Race is a film that me and Dad and Annie and basically you know, everyone,
the whole Bernhard family, yeah,
overdid and overwatched to a wild extent in the 90s. This is you know, a Jack Lemmon, Tony Curtis film from the Blake Edwards movie, late 60s.
Blake Edwards, yeah.
It's really wonderful.
Jack Lemmon is superb.
Just adore it. It's a terrific movie. I don't know if I'd feel that way if I saw it for the first time now, but maybe I would. I don't know. Or maybe it would be kind of a My Name is Nobody situation where I was like, oh, I could see growing up with this. This would be fun, you know? But
Jack Lemmon is still funny.
There's no corollary performance to Jack Lemmon in this. Jack Lemmon's really awesome in Great Race. But, I mean, it is, I could see this playing funnier, you know, if you're younger. And, you know, it has a sort of a, I mean, the tone of Looney Tunes combined with Spaghetti Western is weird. That's an unusual movie, to say the least. You don't often see that. there were a few.
Well,
there were,
you know,
other
but
comedies.
The Looney Tune aspect of it, though, is it makes it a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
So even though we're kind of clueless as to what the heck's going on occasion, you know, it's the vignettes that we've been talking about are fun to watch.
This is the thing about this movie. Yes, ultimately, I mean, I could see how we've kind of been almost giving this a negative review up to this point. That's not the case watching it. Watching it is fun. Watching it, yeah. A lot of these sequences are a blast. A lot of them are really good. I would say most of them come in the second half. Second two-thirds anyway, so it starts a little rough, right. And you don't find your bearings. But I enjoyed this. I thought this was a fun movie. I thought this was a...
So did I.
Yeah. I enjoyed...
I mean, I was a little confused on occasion.
Yes.
But, mm-hmm. But I enjoyed it too.
He's kind of a... Well, this is like... Yeah, it's... Once I kind of understood how to take the film, which was as a series of vignettes, I mean, it clicked for me, I would say. And I clicked with Terrence Hill, which is really, that's what you got to do for this movie to work. Like, if you don't like him, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
Because he's the show. They
well,
meet
you have
up.
You have to accept the idea of him wanting to build the legend of Jack Beauregard as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the whole thing. That's why he's doing all these things. You know, he wants to lure Jack Beauregard into doing something that will turn him into a legend.
Right. Mm-hmm. Not unlike, you know, it's almost like Unforgiven, really.
Whoa. What?
It's not at all like Unforgiven. Who's kidding? There's a kid who comes, and, you know, like, it's like, hey, you're William Money.
Well, you're
you?
Right. There is a kid, yeah. Yeah. You're William Money. Yep. There is a kid, yeah.
Yeah. When they meet up, nobody immediately kind of, like, recognizes him. And he's kind of annoying to him because that's always nobody's first move with when meeting someone is to be irritating. But he does tell him right away. He's like, hey, you're Jack Beauregard. Last hope for law and order in the West, you know. He's reminiscing over hero worshiping Jack Beauregard all through his life. What a great guy he was, you know. And then, you know, and then a cartoon bomb noise goes off behind him. but that's the core of the relationship. And it's, I mean, yeah, he looks up to him like a hero. He's, you know, he's trying to ensure this guy's legacy for all time. And yes, a key part of that is, you know, taking on that legacy a bit at the end himself, which surprised me that he even gave a damn about, honestly. But that is ultimately, you know, part of the Western legend of, you know, the gunslinger, you know, the gunslinger who's always getting chased after for, you know, the kid trying to make his name.
Yeah.
It's playing with that trope a bit, you know. But is it about halfway through that we finally see how fast Nobody is? Is that right? Because he kind of seems
something like that
for a while.
The bar fight?
Which bar fight?
Well, let's see. There's the one scene where the guy gives him the basket to deliver to Beauregard,
mm-hmm.
But we don't see how fast he is there.
Oh no, it's after that scene. Right, that's the bomb that goes off in the background. Some bad guys say, "Hey, take this into that guy, and we'll give you a horse." And he takes it in, and you know, says, "Hey, I'm pretty sure this is a bomb." So, hey, you're Jack Beauregard, you know that? And they throw it out in the street, and it explodes while they're having their scene. And then, when he goes out after that, the bad guy's house has been blown up, and all of them have soot on their faces, like like they had exploding cigars in a Warner Brothers cartoon. And that's when he shows how fast he is, you know. He's like, "What? You mean a draw like this?" They're like, "Oh,
oh, that's right." He says, really, "You should be able to draw three times before the other guy clears leather or something like that."
Yeah, that's how you win. Yeah, yeah. And he demonstrates. And they're like, "Oh, we ain't mad at you no more. We ain't, you know, that kind of thing." The villainous comic foils in this, man, there's a lot of just ugly, ugly men getting getting taken down a peg by Nobody.
Oh, the guy in the bar.
Oh, yeah.
The high squeaky voice.
I hate to speak so ill of somebody, but man, what an ugly rat faced guy.
the voice just freaked me out.
Yeah. This is an ugly film, I think. I mean, well, it didn't help that. I mean, you said you watched it on a computer screen because you couldn't find it to stream anywhere. I got on Amazon Prime, in, you know, the most standard of definitions. Imaginable. I mean, really choppy. I mean, basically, it looks like they converted a VHS copy to you know, digital, and it looks like crap. This film could use a restoration for sure.
Well, there is a Blu-ray copy apparently out there somewhere.
Mm-hmm. I've heard there's the Blu-ray is not very good either. I mean, you know, really? Certainly gonna be better than what we saw, but yeah, this is not a film that has been deemed worthy of a full restoration.
Not yet, anyway. Huh?
I think it'll get one. I mean, this is a cult following, this movie. This is
I was amazed, actually, when I started checking out. Well, not amazed. I liked the film. I really did. But
it's weird enough.
I didn't think it was particularly worthy of a cult following.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it has one. There are people that think this is the best film ever made. You know?
Well, it is a weird film. It is a unique film. And like I was saying, it has two different tones that you don't see often together. And if you are on the wavelength of Terrence Hill, if you are really into what he's doing, then this is a very good performance. This is a really, really winning central performance. Yeah. I allow for the person who is not into what Terrence Hill is doing. I don't know that I was 100% on board with it, but I was able to recognize that he was doing something unique here. This is a unique film in a lot of ways. So I think that would probably be what the cult following appeal is. Although, you know, best film ever is pretty
that's pushing it.
Pretty
yeah.
intense, yeah. it's more of an amble still at this point. I believe we have what's going on? Oh yeah, Beauregard comes across a large bunch of Indians praying in Holy Land. Nobody is praying with them. You know, he just seems to always show up where Beauregard is, and it's starting to bother Peter Fonda. So he decides everything. They're going to kind of have it out, you know, talk this through and figure out what the problem is. He kind of wants to force him into a duel here, you know, because he thinks, correctly, I would think logically that he wants to, you know, have a shootout with him and make his name.
Yeah, but they do the hat shooting thing instead.
Yeah, well, he refuses to draw. So
right.
Fonda just keeps shooting holes in his hat.
Right. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, a lot of hat shooting in this
Terrence
movie.
Hill gets, yeah, right. Terrence Hill gets the hat shooting. You know, it turns the tables later on.
Yeah. There's a lot of that going on. And basically, you know, he just sort of like, well, I'll see you around or something or what? I don't know. Wanders off. And...
Yeah,
I mean
that's when I really got confused at that point with the Indian thing.
Whatever's going on is not expressly made clear, or it's. it's, I don't know. I feel like I'm coming down hard on this, even though I liked it. it's not traditional in the way it presents its story or its or what it's doing. Is that a fair way of categorizing.
Yeah, it's not traditional, that's yeah. for sure.
Then we get to the circus, which I think is where the film kind of starts to really cook, I believe. It's probably my favorite stuff in the movie, is all these circus-related comedy bits going on.
All right, the twisting, turning... the guy they're supposed to smack in the hand or something like that?
Turning
man?
I always saw this in the context of a medieval story, actually. But what it is it's a spinning dummy that you hit, has like two long poles coming out of it, and you hit one side, and that makes it the other side spin around and hits you in the back of the head if you're not careful. And I always saw that, you know, as like medieval knights fighting this thing. But they have it here in the Old West here. And there's a wonderful... Maybe the best set piece of the film is a fight revolving around this thing, I think.
Yeah, see, I thought of Spartacus.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Right. They do have it in Spartacus, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, well, it's for training. It's for military training, you know.
Right.
Here used for, you know, circus clownery. But,
right.
You know, can you drink enough mirrors, and then hit the thing? Yeah, you know. The circus also has him the midget thing, which I loved, or excuse me, little person thing, which is he walks into town and a dwarf on stilts starts yelling at him and just like, get out of my way, shorty. then he pulls out his gun and shoots the stilts out from under the dwarf until till he falls down to his regular dwarf height and is humiliated and has to run away.
It was his own damn fault for giving Terrence Hill such a bad time.
He's a circus performer. That's exactly what he's supposed to do. This whole opening, this whole sequence, he steals a baby's apple while the mom's not looking. I like that. That was great. And what about this scene with the pie fight? The pies. Pies and eggs. That's an insane scene. That's the game, the carnival game.
Some social comment on that one? What do you think?
Boy, wow. The game appears to be throw eggs at these black guys. That's what's going on.
Yeah, stuck their heads through a hole in a wall.
Yeah, there's a carnival barker, encouraging everyone to throw food at these guys, and then nobody says, I'll do it, and throws a pie at the barker instead, and the black guys run away. It's it's a pretty rough scene to watch.
Yeah.
It's got some 70s teeth to it, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Much more so than the rest of the film. It's almost like a scene from, like, Django Unchained, or even a particularly savage episode of The Simpsons, maybe.
Jeez. No, I never would have made that connection.
And I mean, this is about the scene, the circus is about where you can, like, oh, okay, it's a comedy, I can laugh at all this stuff. At least it was for me. I mean, up until then, it was kind of trying to figure out what the hell kind of movie I was even watching, and, get to the circus, is like, oh, okay, it's a weird comedy. And, he's just nobody wandering around screwing up people's days.
Yeah. And showing up with Jack Bogart every once in a while to egg him on.
Yeah.
Into future glory.
But before Bogart shows up, more of this circus scene.
Oh, yeah, the House of Mirrors.
Well, there's the House of Mirrors. That's a little later, actually. First, that there's the later, trick drinking and shooting game. Which is like maybe 12 minutes of screen time. It's the longest scene.
I liked it, though.
Oh, it's great. Great.
Except for the rat-faced guy's voice.
Poor rat-faced guy. He comes into a bar and they're drinking. They get like four drinks lined up in front of them, and after they down one, throw the glass behind them, and they got a mirror they can kind of look at in front of them and turn around and shoot that glass out of the air in a crowded bar full of people.
Yeah, that's great. It's lined like a fairway on a golf course or something.
There are 75 people in this bar. And in between shots, in between him, like when he's drinking, before he turns around and fires into, throws a glass and fires at it, there's people like wandering back and forth in the background. They haven't cleared a path for him until they know they have to. And man, there's a lot of mugging. Terrence Hill mugs a lot in this scene. A lot of pulling faces.
Uh-huh. As he drinks.
Mm-hmm. Well, he hates drinking is another thing until this scene all of a sudden. I wish I could just do with milk. And it's another one of those things that he is actually, despite what it seems, an expert at. This is why I thought he wasn't a real person. This is why I believed him to be some sort of prankster god, or externalization of I don't know, guardian angel for Henry Fonda or something. It's weird that the movie is following him almost. Like, I almost feel like he's this character, like, that sort of just emerges from the mist in the Henry Fonda movie sometimes. And then at the end you find out, oh, he's not a person. But no, it is about him. He's the central character. And he just sort of wanders around without a plan until he has a plan.
I think he always had the plan. It's just that we don't know what the hell it is until a little later.
That's true. But how all of these things lead to that plan?
Yeah, good question. Yeah.
I mean, it's like how the Joker in The Dark Knight, like for being an anarchist who's all about, you know, who talks about how little he plans out, he has incredible leadership skills and foresight and ability to manipulate outcomes. He shoots the last glass out of like a Yul Brynner type's hand when he catches the bar, or catches the beer glass. This guy's supposed to be kind of
Lee
a
Van
Yul Brynner.
For a while.
Was it?
I thought it was Lee Van Cleef for a little while there.
Oh, it's not. But
it's not.
It's interesting. It reminded me of Lee Van Cleef. I thought he was doing a Yul Brynner type in that role, because he's got the Yul Brynner costume. He's a bald dude. Either way. He gets into an epic slap fight with nobody.
Right.
Which is just, nobody slapping him in the face.
Which goes on and on and on.
On and on and on, yeah. Uh-huh. Which gets him invited to the high-stakes game upstairs.
So what prowess, I mean, what slapping prowess, why would that get you into a high-stakes game of poker?
Well, it's not ultimately a real high-stakes game. It's an assassination contract. I didn't know if that was understood by everybody or what, but that was the idea. That Sullivan's up there, right?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
That's right.
Did this remind you of Maverick at all? It reminded me a little bit of Maverick.
At that point, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. The mid-sequence here, I thought. You know,
right.
All the more vignette-based stuff really reminded me of Maverick.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah, Maverick's very heavily vignette-based.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a little bit... It was a lot more of a conventional film, you know. Certainly a much more, you know, logical, conventional story that's being told in Maverick. As in,
there
you can follow it from
there,
point
yeah.
A to point B.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, tonally, I think that it reminded me of that more than any other thing that we've watched. Certainly more than the other Leone film. This is a...
The filming style is reminiscent of the trilogy, though.
Well, of course.
My Name...
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Man with No Name trilogy.
So yeah, he gets invited up to the high stakes game. It's actually the mining magnate who wants him to kill Beauregard, which he accepts. That's the first forward momentum of the plot for a while.
Yeah.
But and so they have an odd little showdown. Like the next scene right away is Beauregard riding into town, and nobody is waiting for him in the middle of the center of the streets, sitting in a chair.
Yeah.
And they have an odd little non showdown, which nobody walks away from.
Yeah. Yeah, what was up with that?
At which point, everybody is confused about what the hell's going on, except nobody. Like Beauregard doesn't understand it. Sullivan doesn't understand it. All the bad guys who are like hanging out, watching, don't understand it. Beauregard thinks nobody's whole deal is he wants an audience. Like he wants people around to see their duel, and that's why he wouldn't fight him earlier.
Which ultimately ends up being the deal with nobody.
That's true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. For slightly different reasons or whatever. And then, yes, the Wild Bunch rides back into town, accompanied by Circus Horn, Ride of the Valkyries again. And nobody is like watching from the distant, from a shack that he's hanging out in, as they load dynamite into their saddlebags. This is the scene you talked about. They ride into town just so we can see them putting dynamite in their saddlebags.
They take over the town. They completely ring the main street of the town. Right?
Uh-huh.
Like they're taking over the town. They don't want anything to happen while they're loading their dynamite. Mm-hmm. You know? No pranksters, nobody, you know, messing with our dynamite here.
Yeah.
And it's very clear what they're doing, right? Hey, check it out here. We're loading dynamite into our saddlebags.
And then they ride off. Yeah. And then they go away. Yeah.
Not before the sun shines on their little chrome pieces on their saddlebags, though.
Yes, to highlight them, like in a video game.
Highlight the saddlebags, which comes in handy later on.
And then guys start trying to kill Beauregard and nobody. And we get a few little minor action sequences, including, I believe, the... is this with the punching machine and
and then the Hall of Mirrors, right?
Uh-huh, and the Hall of Mirrors. This is a great couple of sequences, I think, or maybe it's I like the Ghost House sequence a lot. Actually, it's something you don't expect to show up. All of a sudden, they're wandering around
in a Western.
Yeah. A Ghost House.
True.
And there's a part where there are bad guys. Basically, anybody, any like ugly guy who's hassled nobody for the last half hour or so is all of a sudden a bad guy now who's trying to shoot him down. I think pretty much all of them, except for the stilt midget, are back chasing him through the House of Mirrors. There's a scene with the mirrors where, you know, nobody is projected on every mirror, and they're all like, which one's the real one? As you see in mirror scenes.
That's a lot of mirrors, man. Yeah. I mean, they had, what, 10 mirrors?
Have some lie there. Like, look, it's an army of nobodies. Which one's the real me? Again, I mean, these are good scenes. These are well put together comic Looney Tunes sequences. The punching machine thing is great. One guy just gets that.
Yeah.
Just the shit kicked out of him in that scene. It's way fun. there's a lot of gun tricks. There's a lot of impossible, like, shots in this movie, too. And I always enjoy those, you know? Show-offy kind of stunts and, you know, a lot of shooting people's hats off or shooting the beer out of their hand or... You know, playing pool with guns, stuff like that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes, after these sequences, you know, run around the circus having some shootouts, they go to a pool hall, and that's what this is. Fonda and nobody meet up in a pool hall, and they use they put. I don't even know what they're talking about here, really.
No, they're trying to outdo each other on the pool with the mm-hmm. pool table.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And they're shooting, but you know, they either shoot the ball off the table or they shoot it just enough to make it bounce around and go in one of the holes.
Uh-huh. Oh,
trick almost goes in a hole, and he blows it in.
Trick shoots, right? Trick shooting pool with guns, and there's a. Yeah.
Nothing happens to the table either.
No. They're that good. They're just that good. I believe this is where he's talking about, I know what you're doing. You're here to kill the guy who killed your brother or something like that. This is what nobody thinks that Beauregard is doing. And then he's like, but there's one thing you didn't count on. What about the Wild Bunch? And then he pulls around an insane machine that dumps 75 pool balls onto the table. The most impractical thing that would have no reason.
That's right.
Unless you're at a pool ball manufacturing factory, there's no explanation for this thing. this sets up the general idea that... That Beauregard is going to is getting revenge on somebody, and then he subverts that, but he's just like, no, I'm not. My brother was kind of an asshole, and I'm just getting money that is due to me so I can leave the country. He goes and he makes a deal with Sullivan, leaves with money, and And nobody is surprised. You know, he's like, I thought you wanted to be a hero. He's like, no, you wanted me to be a hero. And it's some sort of subversion of the Western myth. I don't know. It kind of turns into like, you know what it reminded me of at this point was My Favorite Year. Do you remember that?
Vaguely.
The Peter O'Toole.
Just vaguely.
Yeah. As a, you know, sort of washed up, swashbuckling Errol Flynn type. It was just right. a constant disappointment to his army of fans. It's
right.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, so.
That threw me. That thing with Sullivan kind of threw me for a loop. Sullivan never gets it in the end. I thought he was set up as the bad guy, you know, the bad guy to end all bad guys. Mm-hmm. And Fonda just makes a deal with him. All he wants is $500 and a couple of sacks of gold.
Yeah. I like that, actually. I mean, that is a subversion, like I was joking about a second ago, but it's,
yeah.
You know, I didn't care about Sullivan. I didn't need to see him taken down. So I was kind of like, yeah, okay, cool. Fonda's brother means nothing to me, so I don't need to see that resolved. I thought that was kind of great, actually. And then we kind of get into the final run of stuff here, which is Fonda heads off into the distance. You know, he's going off to catch his boat, but nobody has to steal a train first and get this is the urinal.
Train full of gold, yeah.
This is the urinal sequence here.
Oh yeah.
Oh man, is this the creepiest weird scene in the movie?
That is weird.
I don't know. Weird. It's this or the scene where they throw eggs at those black guys. but he like comes into a urinal with the train stops. The guy, the train conductor, gets off to take a piss.
Engineer,
yeah. And nobody follows him into the bathroom, and they have it's urinals that are like facing one another, so like you're looking at somebody right in the eyes as you piss and he pisses, and they just stare at each other. This sequence is maybe this 5 minutes long sequence of, and it's just this middle-aged, maybe older gentleman with kind of overweight, with a bunch of like facial hair, just rubbing his face sensually as he stares at nobody. No dialogue. It's just them staring at each other.
This was somebody's favorite scene, by the way.
It's definitely
in reading some of the reviews.
It's one of the most notable scenes. It's absolutely a notable scene. Just rubbing his face as he stares at him, and finally, they start. Nobody just starts whistling at him, which unsettles him. To the point where he finally is able to piss, which apparently, yeah, he realized that. Oh, yeah, it's just been an old guy, not able to piss, and nobody kind of charm whistles him out of his incontinence, and.
which, given the situation, you don't really understand because nobody's trying to steal the train, right?
Yeah.
So it would behoove him to keep the guy, the engineer, in there as long as possible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, as he has a long, long piss, finally, after being, essentially charmed by nobody. You know, which is just like this guy, you know, close up of this guy's face in relief, and we hear urine sounds. And then he comes out of the door and is like, oh no, someone's stealing the train. Bizarre.
Yeah. Very strange.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, all right. So then he takes off with the train.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Henry Fonda is out. Along, riding along the tracks.
Yeah.
Isn't he? He's just on his way to wherever he's going to catch the boat.
Presumably. Yeah.
And all of a sudden, here's this thundering of hooves. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, it's the Wild Bunch. After Henry Fonda.
But then a train pulls up. Yeah. See, this is what I thought. We're like getting into dream logic here, you know? Like what is this? What is this Wild Bunch actually? What do they represent? Something? Is this, you know, is this his legacy of killing people, catching up with him? Is this is this his passage from man into mythology, into legend, like Jeremiah Johnson? Is this, you know, with nobody as some sort of Virgil-esque guide taking him through the stations of the afterlife before he's able to reach his final reward? This is what I thought was going on in the movie. I really did. Like, there's some meaning here. He's preparing him for the next life, you know, like... measuring, you know, the weight of his sins and deeds. And...
I love it. Well, no, I didn't come up with that.
Well, it doesn't leave you with much else.
Except Terrence Hill's still trying to make a legend out of him.
Yeah, well, you better shoot all those guys up. Now.
Well, he helps him out. He takes out a little mirror and you know, gets the sun reflections to give him a clue. Hey, check out the little chrome things on their saddlebags that are reflecting, you know.
So, yeah, shoot at those. He starts blowing them up. This sequence, by the way, is also apocryphally credited to Sergio Leone. Allegedly, this is all him. You know, who knows? But I guess I can see that. You know, things exploding. You know, a lot of freeze frames. A lot of of it being presented as newspaper material as it's happening. You know, like horses doing face plants as things explode. And it's like front page, and right. He just kills a lot of them and then stops and gets on the train and they leave, right?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah. Wild Bunch have had enough, right?
Yeah, I guess they were after him or what?
Don't they? No, they start riding after the train, don't they?
Yeah.
But never catch up, apparently.
Yeah. And then in typical My Name is Nobody fashion, there's just a weird scene where they eat beans together. Well, soot from the train blows in their face. That takes about... It just goes on for like 3 minutes. That's where they don't talk. They just eat food while soot blows in their face.
That is Sergio Leone.
And then, and now all he has to do to be famous forever is he has to publicly die. Again, I'm still thinking, trying to figure out the metaphysical angle, what plane of existence this is taking place on here, and so they have they cut to a showdown in this busy city street. I think nobody's some sort of weird ghost right now, but
they've selected some very populated area.
Yeah,
because he needs an audience here.
Mm-hmm. And so, these two characters finally get to duel after, you know, sort of walking around it the whole movie. And, but, you know, as you might expect, it's a big fake death thing. Nobody shoots down Beauregard, but he's faking his death, so he can actually become a legend. And so nobody can assume the mantle of, you know, the guy who shot him down.
Yep.
And even, you know, he clearly is a killing machine, as it turns out, so that's okay. That's he will probably wear the mantle, you know, with grace and dignity, I think is the idea, right? And
although during that whole scene, it's Henry Fonda, after he supposedly dies, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's reading his letter to nobody.
Yeah.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Telling
from
him,
the boat,
be careful. You know, you've assumed the mantle now. You got to live with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, someday some kid is going to come along, we've heard that all before.
Yep,
it's someday, going to be faster.
Kid. Yeah. Looking to make a name for himself. And yep. And yeah, and now he is the legend, and Henry Fonda can go back to being nobody, which is what he wants, in Australia, yep, or whatever. And then there's a reprise sort of the opening sequence of Henry Fonda going to the barber shop, but this time it's nobody. And he's worried about getting stalked by assassins too now, as is his lot in life, so he sticks his finger up the guy, the barber's ass. Freeze frame on that, and it's the end of the movie.
End of the movie.
You get that theme. You know? Or you're staring at a picture of this finger sitting between this barber's ass cheeks. Just...
Yeah.
This movie is so weird. This is the strangest thing. I'm completely confused by this movie. But I liked it. I liked it, actually.
I wasn't bored. I wasn't
not
bored.
Not at all. Not at all. I, you know. And to be fair, when I start a new spaghetti western, I'm always being a little like, I hope I'm not bored in this. I hope this isn't slow.
That happens. I gotta say, that happens to me. The spaghetti westerns will do that to me.
The good ones are really good, but the bad ones are not good at all. Yeah.
Oh, but you know, the 5 minutes of watching a fly crawl across a guy's face, you know, I mean, that's I can do without mm-hmm. that.
I was surprised consistently by this movie. I thought it was a lot of fun, even though I didn't fully grasp what I think it was trying to articulate. I enjoyed the comedy aspects of it quite a bit. It's unlike anything I've ever seen. I would give this 3.5 out of 5.
I was going to go 3.
Understandable. yeah. I'm glad we did it. And I want to thank, Stephen for the recommendation. I know this is one of his favorites, so I hope we didn't disappoint in that regard.
I'm still trying to figure it out, though, Steven.
Yeah, I expect I'll see this movie again, though, is the thing. Like, I could see myself returning to this one and coming at this with a new perspective, because I found it singular. I thought it was an interesting experience checking this one out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's a fun movie to watch.
Uh-huh. Any other thoughts on My Name is Nobody?
Nope, that'll do her.
All right. Thank you very much, Stephen. And if you would like to make a request for an episode of this podcast, we take requests. You can just email us what you would like to see us talk about at westernswithdad@gmail.com. That would be great. We would love to hear what you'd like to see. Also, you can leave us reviews and ratings on iTunes and get more of those. We really appreciate those, so please keep that up. What else have you seen recently, Dad?
Oh, I've been watching the 31 Days of Oscar on TCM.
Mm-hmm.
Some great old movies and some very strange, almost disturbing old movies. Like, have you ever seen Morning Becomes Electra?
No, I've not actually seen the film of that. It's
the film version of a Eugene O'Neill play.
It's a creepy play.
Kind of a creepy play, yeah. Mm-hmm. The supremely dysfunctional family that, you know, a lot of people committing suicide and, you know, a hint of incest. And, I mean, oh, my God. I had heard that it was a great film, you know, and so I decided to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And good performances, but
who's in
Rosalind
that?
Russell? Rosalind Russell plays the daughter of this Union officer who's coming back from the Civil War, and apparently this officer has had control over his family, like such a debilitating control over his family that they all hate his guts, except for Rosalind Russell, who's his darling daughter. And his wife, you know, was hoping that he'd be killed in the war, but he comes back, and she ends up killing him with some sort of poison, because he's got a heart condition as well. and she thinks she can pass it off as a heart attack. But it's just, and then the son comes back from the war, and he's got a thing for mom, and it just gets weirder and weirder.
Sounds like Eugene O'Neill. Good, though?
I'd say well acted. Not a movie I'd want to see again.
Fair enough, fair enough. Mm-hmm.
And but seen lots of, you know, have you ever tuned in to 31 Days of Oscar on TCM?
Can't say as I have recently.
They start early February, mm-hmm. and they go a couple of days past the Oscar presentation on the 26th, and they do it alphabetically. Oscar-nominated films, not Best Picture, but like they can maybe only have one nomination for Best Musical Score.
Uh-huh. So that you might see, right? Beetlejuice, because it was nominated for Best Makeup.
Right. Exactly.
All right. Yeah. Is that every film on TCM for the month of February is Oscar nominated for something? Or
I think so.
Oh,
yeah.
That's ambitious. All right. I mean, there have been hundreds and hundreds at this point.
That's pretty cool. I mean, I've seen Jaws. I watched Jaws the other night.
Is there a better movie than Jaws?
Oh, Jaws is unbelievably good. In every aspect.
I can't. So good. I have no idea how many times I've seen that film. My God, it's just the best. The best.
There's movie. Nothing wrong with that movie. It's just it's superbly filmed.
Robert Shaw, man. Yeah. Was he nominated for Best Supporting Actor for that? Because my God,
I think he was. Yeah, I think he was. Been. Yeah. And the movie was nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah, should have won. I don't remember what I was up against. What was 75.
That Rocky won that year? Wasn't it Rocky that won?
Yeah, that makes sense.
That year,
I would still vote for Jaws. I love Rocky, but I would vote for Jaws. Yeah. Yeah. I saw. I've actually watched a number of movies the last couple of weeks. I've had some time off from work. Mm-hmm. I saw The Name of the Rose again. I love that movie. That movie's awesome.
Ooh, that's a great movie.
That movie's terrific. Yeah. They
do. I don't
a great
understand
job
why the critics didn't like that.
I don't get it either. I mean, it's the book it's based on is a masterpiece, so it's tough to compare it to that, but they do a really good job of it. Like, they nail the pertinent stuff about that book, and it really captures, you know.
Did you read the book?
I did. Have you read the book? Yeah. It's awesome.
No, I haven't read it.
Oh, dude. Yeah. If you like the movie, it's fantastic, and it's one of the best books I've ever read. Umberto Eco was insane about it. He built a scale model of the Abbey and would trace the path of characters as they walked across the courtyard to determine how long the conversation would be. Stuff like that. Like, crazy, crazy stuff. And so it's a little bit in the shadow of the book, but man, is it a good version of it. And what I love most about it is how dirty and scary it appears to be living in the Middle Ages. It is the least romantic version of the Middle Ages. It's just miserable. Everyone looks terrible. Everyone's bald, and they look cold and wet all the time. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They're all terrified of demons. Just like everyone thinks there's going to be a demon, like right around the corner all the time. Like believes in their soul. It's such a it's really good. I really enjoy it. I watched Sully yesterday. Tom Hanks film, Clint Eastwood directed version of the.
How was that?
I thought it was really great. I think it's the best thing Clint Eastwood's done in over 10 years.
Wow!
I thought, I'm surprised that this one didn't get any Oscar traction. Actually, it's not a perfect film, not at all, but it's entertaining. It doesn't overstay its welcome, and it presents the actual story in a very good verite kind of. Well, that's maybe a little grand, but it really puts you in the place. And I mean, I was here on the day that happened in New York, so I kind of remember the news coverage. It covers it very well. Like, it really captures that day perfectly. Tom Hanks is, you know, he's the perfect guy to cast in a role like that. It's it has its issues. They create villains for him to fight against. That's kind of unnecessary, but. But for the centerpiece of the film, like the 45-minute sequence covering the crash in the Hudson River, is awesome. It's really good, and knowing everyone survives makes it like a totally upbeat, you know, disaster. So it's kind of great. and the other one I wanted to talk about, I saw John Wick Chapter 2 in theaters.
Torben and I want to go see
that. Oh, you got to go see it, Dad. It's great. It's not as good as the original. It is not as good as the first John Wick. But what is? The action is... They step up the action. The action is better. All the rules of the world, they go deeper in that stuff. You know, all the things about, you know, the weird little touches like the Assassin Hotel and things like that. They go even deeper on all of that. There's some unbelievable.
Well, does he get sucked back in then?
Oh yeah, of course, of course.
Of course he does.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's never getting out. I think is the that's I think what they ultimately. Yeah. If they keep making these movies, and it looks like they will, because this one's a hit. I think ultimately what they're about is he's never out. He's never going to be able to leave this life. And it's almost like some sort of he's traveling through the afterlife on his way to.
So tell me what's the premise here? Did they kill another dog or what?
No dogs get killed. This one. He is called back into the service, because he made a blood oath with a member of the Camorra in Italy, and he has no choice but to fulfill his end of this before he can be free of his marker. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wait a minute, I thought he was with the Russian mob.
Yes, but well, you want to, okay, the deep cut version here. When he was tasked with completing an impossible mission by Vigo in the first film, or prior to the first film, he required the assistance of this member of the Camorra. So he abided by, submitted to a blood oath, a marker, as they place it, which is this little medallion with a sharp thing in the center that you cut your thumb on and leave a blood imprint on the center.
okay.
That must be called into, you know, that you must be answered when called back. And so he's brought back into the life by this. Everyone who survived the first movie is in it again, returns. Everyone from the Continental. There's more Continental in this. Some of the best action scenes. There's some incredible action scenes. There's a Hall of Mirrors action scene, as a matter of fact. and it's just a delightful film. There's a great, great... Just street brawl between him and Common in it. Oh, you got to see it, Dad. It's great. Also,
yeah, we will.
Pertinent to us, read an interview with the director, Chad Stulhansky, guy's name, asking about his influences. He said Open Range.
Wait. Start over again? What?
The guy who directed John Wick 2, Chad Stulhansky, asked about, in an interview, about his influences for John Wick Chapter 2. He said, Open Range, for sure. Read an interview with him.
No kidding.
Yeah, slashfilm.com. Right. Specifically, he was talking about...
the shootout in the street.
Yes, the shootout in the street. A lot of Kevin Costner's moves in the final action scene in Open Range. When he pops that guy in the head as he's holding Annette Bening. And when he comes up to the best gun at the... during the parlay, and before it's over, shoots him in the face.
Two highlights, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, influences for John Wick.
Interesting.
I can see where they came into play in John Wick 2. That's a good film. I recommend that. All those movies. All those movies I just said, I liked all of them a ton. They're great movies. Mm-hmm.
Well, we want to get out. I want to get out and see... Another one coming out soon is Logan. I really want to see that.
Logan looks great, right?
The last Wolverine movie.
Yeah, that'll be out by the time we do our next episode. So I bet we talk about it then. Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks awesome. Looks like Unforgiven. Looks like Unforgiven
superheroes.
Yeah.
What's that?
Looks like Unforgiven with superheroes.
Yeah.
Right? Looks great. But yeah, John Wick's great too. Go see it. Mm-hmm.
Sounds great.
Okay. I suppose we'll be talking about just next week, next episode, then, right?
Next, 2 weeks from today.
2 weeks from today, it's going to be another request. This is going to be Last Train from Gun Hill, which is Kirk Douglas and Anthony Quinn. It is a John Sturges film, director of The Magnificent Seven and others. And so that's gonna be a bunch of fun. I'm looking forward to this one. I don't think we've done those people we have not done really yet on the podcast. Kirk Douglas.
Anthony Quinn. Yeah, I haven't done an Anthony Quinn movie.
So that'll be the next time. Next time, Last Train from Gun Hill. I never seen it myself. Very excited. So thank you very much for joining us again for My Name Is Nobody. Take care.
All right. Adios, amigos.